Hello, Joan. How are you today?
Hi, Con. I'm fine. How are you?
You're finally back in Seattle from Chicago, right?
Finally back in Seattle after Chicago, after Idaho. I've been on the road.
And you hosted, or you were one of three moderators for the Yearly Coast Forum out in Chicago, right?
Yeah, the Presidential Forum, along with Matt Bai and Jeffrey Feldman.
Now, we had some technical difficulties, so this blogging hint as far as the Yearly Coast Forum is going to be a little late for everyone.
Sort of old news. Let's
go ahead and start off with the Daily Coast news from yesterday, and that is Marcos appearing on Meet the Press with Harold Ford. Did you watch The Exchange?
I watched The Exchange.
And how did you think your he's not your boss. I guess he's your
my co-blogger,
Marcos did? Partner in crime,
that's a good one. I think Marcos did really well. I was very pleased his first Meet the Press debate. I think he acquitted himself extremely well.
Yeah, it was first kind of debate, but he had an appearance before with Jerome Armstrong promoting his book with Tim Russert.
Right. This was a little bit more challenging.
Going toe-to-toe. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't his first time to the studios up there on Nebraska Avenue.
No, not the first time. And he did really well. I was surprised at the rather conciliatory tone that Harold Ford took with Marcos, considering he'd spent a few weeks sort of trashing us in the Wall Street Journal on Fox News. It was encouraging to see him talk about there are fewer differences between Democrats than there are differences between Democrat and Republican. That's pretty much all we need the DLC to say.
I know. He definitely seemed like he was on the defensive. I know Armando over at Talk Left had a similar take, was impressed with Ford's conciliatory tone. But, you know, I wonder how much of that is, you know, Ford with his finger in the air, figuring out which way the wind's blowing, and how much of it is true love for Daily Coast.
It's not true love for Daily Coast, because when he was pressed hard about the Fox News thing, he did pop up with O'Reilly's canard about the anti-Semitic comments and that business from Fox News. I think that probably having all of the presidential candidates but Biden show up at Yearly Coast while blowing off essentially the DLC forum.
That's right, but Bill Clinton did go down there to say hi.
Bill Clinton was there to say hi. That was important. We had Hillary.
Yeah, you had the more relevant one.
At the moment, the more relevant one.
There you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, as conciliatory a tone as he struck, you know, it seemed to me from the majority of blog posts I read today that he really did step on all his progress he made with what you mentioned earlier about the O'Reilly talking points, basically complaining about the anti-Semitic stuff he's read on Daily Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that that was most of all what the people at Daily Coast focused on.
It was, because it offends most of the people at Daily Coast to be labeled as anti-Semitic.
That's not terribly surprising.
No.
I mean, I think my headline in the Blogometer today was, saying Harold Ford shouldn't be calling Cossacks anti-Semitic the same way John McCain shouldn't be out there calling conservatives racist when it comes to immigration. You just don't go and call large swaths of your base, you know, intolerant people.
Right. When we've been over it again and again and again, it's a handful of commenters, most of whom are trolls. All of those things that it unfortunately is an idea that has taken hold among certain people that were anti-Semitic, and I'm afraid that's going to push forward. So we'll just have to keep beating that one down. But no, it's not a good way to make friends in the blogosphere.
No, you know, I thought Marcos' response was fairly nuanced. You know, he said, "Look, you know, we have 130,000 people commenting on our blogs. We can't, you know, strike down anything all the time. And it's just a democratic forum, and people are going to have, you know, unpopular views." And, you know, also, like you say, you guys do have people, trolls, as you call them, going into your website, specifically posting dirtier stuff just to discredit you. But you guys have a number of countermeasures.
We do have a number of countermeasures. Stuff does get through. They'll go on to old threads where people aren't active anymore, and so you don't see it. It's very hard to combat. But I thought Marcos's point was good, And that he stressed, we had hundreds of thousands of users making comments, participating. So it's very hard to control that message, whereas the DLC isn't so member-oriented, and controlling the message coming out of the DLC is much easier. I thought that was a good point.
Do you see any part of larger reapproachment with the DLC? I mean, you know, Ford did kind of extend an olive branch yesterday despite the anti-Semitic comments. Do you think you might see some project with the DLC down in the future, or is it just, you know, they figured out, you know, for the most part what needs to be said, and they're just going to acquiesce to you guys when they can and kind of bide their time?
Well, it depends on how the DLC determines whether or not it's going to stay relevant, become relevant, actually. In the last several years, particularly after the 2006 election, the DLC has really lost a lot of its credibility, a lot of its relevance. The Democratic Party has more or less passed them by. So it's going to depend on how they react to that and whether they try to adjust to the new political climate. That it's better to appeal to your strong Democratic base, it's better to be a proud Democrat, than it is to try to appease Republicans.
So it seems your guys' basic position is, you know, as long as you don't badmouth us, we have open arms, you know, we'll work with
right.
you as much as we can.
Don't badmouth us or badmouth other Democrats. And that's been the DLC tendency that we've most railed against. Don't speak ill of other Democrats. And it's been a problem with the DLC for quite a while. And, you know, again, Ford going on to Fox News and bringing up the anti-Semitic stuff, that's just one more example of that bad habit.
It's like a nervous tick they can't quite get rid of.
It is. And the thing is, be proud to be a Democrat. We're doing really well right now. The Democratic Party has the ideas that are in line with the majority of the population. Daily Kos, as representative of the Democratic Party, isn't just the liberal wing of the party. We really are the center. We're where the majority of Democrats in the country are, whether it's on getting out of Iraq or healthcare reform or protecting Social Security. We're right there with where all the people are. And we're a rather big tent group, from Stephanie Herseth all the way to Sherrod Brown, Russ Feingold. We've got a lot of people that we support.
Well, there's got to be a lot of people in D.C. who see it your way, because otherwise you wouldn't have all the major Democratic candidates showing up to your presidential forum.
I think so.
So, speaking of which, you hosted that forum with Matt Bai and Jeffrey Feldman.
Mm-hmm. Matt Bai, who writes for the New York Times
right.
magazine, and Jeffrey Feldman, who has Frame Shop, the blog.
Right.
Has written a
how
book
how did you bring Matt Bai into the fold? Because he's a old school MSMer.
That was a decision made by Gina Cooper, the convention organizer.
And what's Gina's background?
Gina is a high school teacher.
Okay.
Who, like the rest of us, got into blogging in the early 2000s in response to the Bush administration, in response to the war. And came to the fore when we were trying to put together this crazy little meeting of bloggers back in Las Vegas in 2006. You know, originally it was just going to be, let's all get together for a weekend someplace convenient so we can meet in person and just talk, have some fun, maybe party a little bit, and talk about how we go
Vegas
forward.
Is good for that.
And it turned into a four-day extravaganza with panels and speakers and Harry Reid and Barbara Boxer.
And then would-be presidential candidates.
And then would-be presidential candidates who are not presidential candidates.
No, Warner and Clark are no longer, well, they're with us, but not in the presidential
race. Not in the presidential race.
Right. So did Gina Cooper have her own blog, or she was just at Daily Kos?
She doesn't have time to blog anymore.
Did she have a history and event planning?
She doesn't have time to blog anymore, putting together these conventions. She's executive director. Pops up in comments at Daily Kos. She did have her own blog for a while, but I don't think she had time to keep it up. She might be going back to it in her off time now. She made friends with Matt Bai last year when he wrote an article about Yearly Kos, if I'm remembering correctly. I could be remembering that wrong. He's written pretty good stuff, sort of mixed stuff about the blogs, but pretty fair. And we thought that it would be a good perspective to have on the panel. sort of so, the pairing of traditional media and new media.
So I know, you know, Gina Carucci's basically just kind of volunteered her time, and I see you guys asking, you know, a little tip jar for her and the rest of the Yearly Co. staff.
Yeah.
Was there any type of other budget, and you know, what is the, was it just basically, you know, fees to join the convention, or how is it, where'd the money come to put the show on?
We had sponsors, and you can go to the yearlycoastconvention.org page and see our sponsors, one of which was JetBlue, briefly,
right,
with its 10 tickets. It did keep the 10 tickets with us, although they wanted their logo brought down. But a variety of sponsors and registration fees. Everybody who attended had to register and pay a fee.
But for the most part, it was just very volunteer, you know,
yeah,
I don't say I'm professional, but, you know, just...
1.5 staff people. Gina and a part-time assistant for her, who, phenomenal woman, Carolyn Dolchenis, who worked really hard. I know it was more than half time in trying to help schedule all of the panels, organize all of the speakers, take care of flight arrangements. I know she didn't work just half time doing that.
But I guess the larger point is that these aren't people who were in some type of, you know, weren't very politically active beforehand. But
they may
you know,
have been politically active at the local level, probably
right,
volunteering with campaigns, you know, and activists like any of us in the Bloc community are, but have certain set of skills, some dealing with the press, some dealing with staging, actually putting on shows with the lights and the audio and all of these kinds of things. These volunteers just come to the fore and say, here's my area of expertise, how can I help?
Right, but do I kind of work back with, you know, what Marcos's point is, these are people who are really kind of more inspired by what's going on at Daily Coast and wanted to increase their participation with the party,
right,
you know, through this vehicle. And this is, I mean, this is, you know, really more of a, you know, bottom-up phenomenon.
Very much so. Very much so. And that's how the panels were organized as well. It was all bottom-up. There was nothing that came from Gina or from any of the other organizers to say, we will have a panel on this. It was all people who were willing to come up with the idea and then do the hard work over the intervening months to make it actually happen. So all of it's bottom up.
So moving to the panel itself, I mean the forum itself, I thought that, you know, first year debate and then the AFL-CIO debate last Tuesday were, you know, just markedly different from the earlier debates on either side so far. I mean, for all the talk about the new YouTube debate, I thought the big difference for your debate and the AFL-CIO debate was the fact that there was a raucous, you know, very partisan audience that was really interacting with the candidates. What was the thought going into that? Was there any, you know, effort to control the crowd, or, you know, what did you guys think of as, or did any of the campaigns really try to shut down the crowd reaction at all, or what was the thinking going into that?
We knew we weren't going to really be able to shut down 2,000 Cossacks. it's a raucous crowd, and they were very, very excited that we had all of the presidential candidates there. We didn't want to try to tamp down that excitement. One thing we did do just to try to keep the atmosphere as conducive as possible to getting as much information in 90 minutes as we possibly could was to ask that people not bring in signs. We did have a little bit of crowd control in that way, that you could only bring in something the size of a handbag, so you couldn't bring in a sign, you couldn't bring in anything to create a demonstration, because we really didn't want to have any kind of eruption in the crowd that would end up
right,
just taking time away from the debate. So, but booing, hissing, applauding, cheering, ovations, all of that was encouraged. Yeah.
All of that was encouraged. And the more open-ended aspect of it also ended up leading to the biggest news item out of the forum.
The lobbyist discussion, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Do you want to recap how that kind of broke out? Because it was a question originally to John Edwards, who then kind of put it to the rest of his mm-hmm. fellow candidates.
Well, it was interesting. It was following up on a question that I thought was not loaded at all. It was the idea of how do you support Howard Dean's 50-state strategy? What would you do as a presidential candidate to support that, or as the eventual nominee? And we ended up in the lobbying discussion. That surprised me. I didn't think we were going to get that out of it. I think Edwards came into it wanting to make that challenge to the rest of the candidates, saw that opening and took it. And I was pleased with that. I was really pleased. That's one of the reasons why we designed it to be rather open-ended. We wanted to try to encourage that kind of conversation between the candidates, a conversation that we hadn't seen yet in any of the debates. So we sort of were prepared to put aside our script. We all had questions we wanted to use, but we wanted to be able to put that aside and let that kind of organic conversation flow. And it worked out very well. Although I felt a little bad for Clinton. She got tag-teamed there. And it also, I thought, marked a rather major change in the debates from where Clinton was rather deferred to. She seemed to be, in all the previous debates, the leader of the pack, and everybody treated her as such with great deference. And this debate signaled the end of that, I think.
That's something I noticed, too. I mean, both with your debate and Olbermann's debate, it seemed as though, you know, beforehand when she was with Anderson Cooper or Wolf Blitzer or whoever else, specifically, you know, kind of a tactic by questioning the authority of the moderator to ask questions and what they're how they're trying to frame the debate, she was able to seem, you know, presidential and experienced and able to kind of command the forum and you know, look like, you know, a woman among boys. But I don't know if it was because of an audience that was, you know, less sympathetic to her or because the questions were coming from their own presidential candidates or because there were, you know, three moderators. Whatever the issue was, she just wasn't able to command the room like she did before. Yeah. And I think it happened again with the Soldier Field crowd and Keith Olbermann.
It did. It was an interesting dynamic to watch, particularly up there on stage. I think probably the format had a lot to do with it, the informal format, everybody sitting around talking. It lent to a much more intimate, it felt like, atmosphere between the candidates. They were sitting very close together.
And all sitting, not standing.
All sitting, not standing, and I think that made a big difference, too. Much more comfortable. I was glad we were sitting. It seemed not just, though, to engage those three in conversation, but it was the most engaged I had seen Bill Richardson in any debate, and Chris Dodd as well. I thought it really, I don't think anybody won our debate, but I think the two who probably did the most good for themselves in our debate were Chris Dodd and Bill Richardson.
Any particular issues you thought I did well on, or just the forum was good for them?
The forum was good for them, but on all of the issues, they were the most engaged and involved in the conversation. They weren't shut out of the conversation.
But what about going back to Hillary, Obama, and Edwards? You said Hillary got ganged up on. I noticed Marcos has definitely kind of changed his tone with Hillary after that exchange. He definitely did not like her answer at all on that. What do you feel about the Daily Coast community at large? How do they come down on that lobbyist money issue and then you personally?
Personally, I think that the lobbyist question is a bit of a canard. None of them are completely pure in who they are taking money from, how they are funding their campaigns. So while it's a good issue for a very partisan, people-powered crowd, I think that we need to do a little bit more research before anybody's throwing stones on where the money's coming from. I don't know how much resonance it's going to keep with the community. It's a long, long campaign. That was definitely a hit against her. But she made a lot of gains just by showing up, by rearranging her schedule so that she could indeed do a breakout session with us, which most of the people coming out of were pretty impressed with.
And unlike everyone else, because of the scheduling conflict, she did her breakout session beforehand. Presidential with everyone else, and everyone else did their breakout sessions afterward.
Yeah. And it would have been interesting to have seen what difference it would have made, whether it would have been much tougher for her had this lobbyist question come up in the breakout sessions, if it had happened afterward.
Yeah, definitely, it definitely would have. Was there any, what was the organizing of the breakout sessions was? I mean, because they were a smaller room because they were trying to be intimate.
Right.
How is it decided who is going to be in those sessions and who asked the questions there?
Anybody could ask the questions. we showed up at registration and...
Well, then let me rephrase that. How was it decided what questions got asked?
It depended on who was running the session. In most of the candidates, you're talking about the breakout sessions.
The breakout sessions, right.
Yeah, it was just you raised your hand, and if they called on you, you got to ask your question.
So who was the they in the Hillary session?
In the Hillary session, I think it was Peter Dow.
Okay. Who is...
Was sort of facilitating.
And who is Peter Dow?
Peter Dow is her internet coordinator, very revered blogger by all of us on the left, who originally wrote the Dow Report and has taken a leave from doing that to work on the Clinton campaign.
And the Dow Report was kind of like a roundup of, was it just conservative blogs or liberal and conservative blogs?
Liberal and conservative blogs.
Liberal and conservative blogs, okay.
And with sort of his own blog post every day, surveying the field, surveying the issues. Peter's brilliant. Fantastic blogger. And a very good addition to the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, no, as soon as he was hired, I wrote, it was a great pickup for them. He was, it's hard to find people as widely respected in the liberal blogosphere as he was. And for someone with problems in that community like Hillary, it was a good get for her.
Yeah, it was. And I have great respect for Peter.
Moving on to Yearly Coast itself, there was Matt Iglesias, who was at the conference, spoke about how he thought Yearly Coast, which I guess next year is going to be called Netroots Nation,
Netroots
right?
Netroots Nation, yeah. We want to shift the brand away from Marcos so much. He already gets enough attention.
So less of a focus on Daily Coast itself and more of the broader movement.
Right, because it is a much broader movement. We might be, for now, the epicenter of it, but that could certainly change. And there's so many great blogs out there that it's not really fair to pigeonhole.
Just have that name on it. And so that kind of fits into Iglesias' point, is that he thought, dealing with all the panels and all the different issues being covered, that it really kind of felt more like a conservative political action conference, a CPAC conference, which is a conference of movement conservatives that have been going on for decades now. Reagan showed up every year. Bush never did,
right.
But Reagan did. I'm guessing you've never been to a CPAC conference.
I've never been to a CPAC conference. It's
kind of
funny.
But would you second that general idea that kind of is what the Netroots Nation conference is turning into?
The Democrats are getting organized. That's a shock for people I know, that we would potentially be as organized as the Republicans. I'm not concerned that it's going to lose its bottom-up feel or lose its sort of organic feeling, because it is, at the heart of it, always going to be a community-based kind of event. I don't think that issue groups are ever going to be able to really run it or control it, because it's gonna remain bottom-up. It's going to remain dependent upon a lot of volunteer activity. Most of the issues, most of the panels that we create are going to continue to come from the blogging audience, from commenters, diarists, all over the blogs. A handful from top bloggers. I had a few panels that I organized in this one.
What was your favorite of those panels?
The favorite of mine? Our new leaders. No, our future leaders. I'm sorry.
Future leaders. And those are our office holders or candidates?
Candidates who ran in 2006 in some of our toughest districts in Nebraska and Wyoming and Idaho, who came closer than anybody's come in years and years, and who are going to run again. An exciting group of people. That, for me, that was the most exciting part of the convention, was seeing how many candidates we had show up. We had about 45 from Senate to congressional to local races. And for me, that's the heart of what it is we're doing. We're a people-powered movement, and it's people who've decided, okay, enough, I'm going to run for office.
Now, I know it seems kind of silly, since we, obviously talking to you, managing editor of, or one of the contributing editors to Daily Coast, and Gina Cooper organized the conference, but there's a Washington Post article, and Ellen Goodwin has written a piece, and there's been a lot of mainstream media worrying about the diversity of Ulicos. I think the Washington Post pointed out or noted, tried to describe it as, you know, very male-orientated, white male-orientated audience.
Not at all like the traditional media. It would be sort of interesting if they turned that question more introspectively and looked at themselves. It's sort of going to become a new theme, I think, along with the anti-Semitic business. It's a what is perceived as possibly a chink in our armor. But I think a lot of people, Miss Laura at Daily Coast this weekend addressed it. Jane Hampshire had an excellent post. Digby's talked about it. All of these are women, or all of these are prominent women who are out there in the blogosphere. Most of us are white, yes, but it's certainly not an entirely white, male, middle-aged venture. I was up there on the presidential forum stage, and I'm not a guy.
It's true. No, you know, I read lots of blogs, and I just thought it was, you know, a silly point to begin with. You know, covering in the Connecticut Senate race, which was dominant in the news for Blogometer last year. A lot of it driven by Jane Hampshire at Fire Dog Lake.
Yeah.
People point to Ariana, but I you know, Ariana has her own history and background. I would say she's a relative to the Netroots movement, but I really wouldn't consider her hardcore. But there are many others, and like you mentioned, Digby, and of course your presence along with Miss Laura and Susan G at Daily Coast.
Right.
So you know, I do think that there's definitely. I feel a more maybe it is a little bit more white than the general population.
Right. But it's also ignoring the point that Marcos Moulitz is Latino and Greek, and
yes,
and self-identifies
as half
Latino.
Greek.
Yeah.
but I guess to me, if, you know, the blogging world has a certain irreverence to it. You know, that you see with Atrios and his Wanker of the Day.
Right.
And Marcos is never inhibited when he speaks to mind. And so for me, you know, kind of the more outspoken Jane Hampshire's of the world and Digby's of the world always personified part of the Netroots.
Right.
So whenever people said it was too male, I just thought it was silly. It's like you're not reading the good stuff that's out there that
right.
women are writing.
Right. You're missing a huge part
you're,
of it.
You're missing some entertaining stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, even, you know, hardcore Netrooters, you know, like Chris Bowers, well, you know, who looks at the blog ads data, who looks at the Pew readership, acknowledge that there is, especially on the race side of it, a gap between the rest of the nation's population and the Netroots.
And I think that's probably politics as a whole.
Right.
It's a hobby. It's a hobby primarily for more affluent white people, unfortunately.
Politics is a hobby, and you have to have the resources to be active within
that
hobby.
Yeah. Does that mean we shouldn't reach out? No, it does not mean we shouldn't be trying to reach out, but that's in the larger movement of trying to get more groups involved in the political process, not just blogging.
Now, I was looking at the I was counting heads at the contributing editor numbers at Daily Coast, and you got 15 of them, and 6 of them are 15 contributing editors, and 6 of them are women.
Yep.
Are there any you know, outreach efforts specifically? Anything proactive Daily Coast is doing to reach out to minorities and women, or do you guys have any, you know, proactive efforts? Or is it just more of, you know, people who show up and do good, those are the ones that get promoted?
It's the latter. It's merit-based. Marcos doesn't think about whether you're African-American or Hispanic or female when you're blogging. He sees a username, associates it with good work, and that's enough for him. In fact, for a long time, I think he thought Georgia 10 was... writing
was a congressional district?
Yes, a congressional district. didn't occur to him for a while that it was a Greek woman in Chicago.
Could be a woman named Georgia.
Yeah.
Now, there also was some scuttlebutt with Barack Obama, who had a exclusive session with some bloggers, Ezra Klein, Matthew Glazes, Brian Buehler, and Garance and Jane Hampshire were all noticed that among the, I guess, 13 to 14 bloggers that were there, there was only one woman there. Do you think,
Garance, that
speaks to a larger issue of Obama, not doing well among women as opposed to Hillary, who, obviously is doing much better among women?
If Garance was there and Jane was there, he had at least two women.
No, they weren't there. They were reporting from other sources.
Oh, okay.
This is the blogosphere. This is all third-hand information.
I've missed this one completely. I didn't know that this smaller meeting took place and that others had reported on it.
I think Garance described it as a meeting for only in-the-tank Obama bloggers, so I guess you're not...
For those who've already
committed. As an in-the-tank Obama blogger.
It must be those who've already committed to Obama. Well, any of us. There's a small number, a very small number of bloggers who've committed to any candidate at this point.
It's true.
So, I think that's probably more a feature of his meeting than anything else.
Moving on to one last issue is the FISA law that got passed right before everyone hit... vacation last week.
Yeah, while we were all in Chicago. And not
exactly.
Able to keep tabs.
That's the only reason they were able to pull it off is that the Daily Coaches were distracted. Just how George Bush and Karl Rove drew it up, right?
Exactly.
Going forward, what's the progressive plan of action, or is there one, to make sure that when the FISA bill is up in 6 months, that it doesn't happen again?
Well, the important thing is that we don't forget over the next 6 months that we have to keep having this battle. It's going to be a prolonged one. Sometimes these sustained fights are the more difficult ones to have when we're used to reacting to breaking news, to following the latest, assault of the day. Gearing up for this six-month-long fight, pushing hard against all of our members of Congress, but particularly those who voted for this horrible thing, and doing what we can to sort of toughen up the spines of Democratic leadership to not let this happen again, to repeal this thing. It's going to be very difficult once it's already passed to repeal it. We recognize that, but we're going to try.
One politician that I always focus on, because he was... there was a draft movement to get him involved in the race. There's a online moment, a YouTube moment that helped propel his campaign. And he's been very popular on populist economic issues, is James Webb. And Webb voted for the FISA bill, and he also voted for the Iraq supplemental.
Yeah.
Does that concern, the people in the Netroots that worked so hard for him? And is there any type of outreach or... re-education efforts to bring him back in the larger fold?
I think there were probably an awful lot of calls from Virginians in the blogosphere to his office after that vote. We recognize that he's coming from a much more conservative place on national security issues than most bloggers. And recognizing that, we're still disappointed in this vote. We're going to keep working on him. We're going to keep pushing on this one. Because, for one thing, because he's coming from a very conservative place on national security issues, he could be a really valued spokesperson for us in fighting the Bush administration on Iraq.
That's one of the reasons I paid very close attention to him, because he has such credibility, with being a Navy Secretary under Reagan, having a son there in Iraq.
Yeah.
It would be a strong voice to have, but he's just, he's not been there all the time.
Right.
When the progressive movement needed him.
He's conservative, and we're going to keep working on him. Hopefully he'll be responsive to his constituents. We are disappointed in Webb. This wasn't one of the things that we worked so hard for him for. On the whole, he's been pretty good in talking about the populist issues particularly. I'd note that our other great Senate hero, John Tester, did vote against this.
And, of course, both all Obama and Clinton, all the senators,
the
Dodd,
yeah,
voted against it.
Yeah.
But other than Dodd, you know, and Dodd's been doing work on habeas, leading on that. You know, Clinton and Obama have been largely absent on habeas, and they definitely didn't lead on FISA. I can't think of any, you know, statements, any fighting they made against the FISA bill. Is there any worry heading into 08 that Obama and Clinton, you know, aren't with the movement on FISA?
They're with the movement on FISA, but they could be a lot more strongly with the movement. I think they're still listening to their consultants too much. They're being far too cautious, particularly Obama. I've been surprised by this for quite a while, watching his campaign, thinking that if he really wanted to make strong inroads against Clinton, he would tack far to her left, particularly on Iraq, because he's got the background to do that. He was opposed to the war from the beginning. He's got the strong base of support on that. Why he's not drawing on that more? Being out front in opposition to the Iraq war, to the supplemental, to the FISA stuff, it's curious to me. I think he's missing a big opportunity. I think he's being too cautious.
No, I've been mystified by it. I thought back in January when he you know, originally announced that there was a huge opening for him to, you know, not only, you know, ride the wave of the Netroots, mm-hmm, but to build on it, you know, himself, build his,
yep,
own kind of movement. But, you know, while he's definitely, you know, built his own movement and has, you know, strong numbers on Facebook and he's very popular on college campuses, he's just not, you know, been out front on a lot of the other big Netroots issues, whether it be Iraq, FISA, etc. And I just can't figure out why that is.
Well, it's not just Netroots issues, particularly when you're talking about Iraq. It's the entire country. I don't understand it. I think perhaps it's the caution of David Axelrod, who's not been known to be the kind of guy who shakes things up a lot. So we'll see. I mean, he still has the opportunity to do it, I think. It'd be a big shift for him now. I hope he does it. Somebody needs to.
Especially after the unilateral action in Pakistan comments, which he,
yeah,
refused to. I thought that was a very interesting moment in the AFL-CIO debate, when you had Dodd and Biden attacking him,
mm-hmm,
you know, Dodd asked him, you know, is this a mistake? You know, will you admit you made a mistake on this comment? And he did not back down. He did not want to admit he made a mistake on it and pressed forward.
And he's not going to admit he made a mistake on it. And there's been a lot of talk in the blogosphere. Was it a mistake? Was it not a mistake? It was, however you view his response, it was definitely a major stumble on the part of the campaign. And it's going to haunt him.
I know. It seems like, you know, taking the same page from Hillary's book on not apologizing for Iraq. It's they both seem to have this idea that, you know, I said it, it's out there, and any type of apology or acknowledgement of mistake would be a sign of would be weakness.
Yeah. Which is sort of how politics works. That's how being a presidential candidate works, for better or for ill. Being able to say you made a mistake is important, and that's one of the ways Richardson, going back to the presidential forum we had a year ago, that's probably the best thing Richardson could have done for himself. When he said, I screwed up on that,
yeah,
answer.
Yeah, that was the first question. He started off saying,
yeah,
he made a mistake,
yeah,
saying he would appoint White would be his favorite Supreme Court nominee.
Yeah. And it also maybe is a clue that you need to do a little bit more research before going into a debate.
Especially on something like the Supreme Court, people,
yeah,
might ask questions about that.
Yeah, that one's going to be a pretty likely question.
Great, well, we'll end it there. Great talking to you from Seattle today, Joan.
Good to talk to you. The other Washington.
The other Washington, yes. And we'll catch up with you again later.
Okay, great. Thanks, Con.
Bye.